Tonight, we have the extraordinary honor of having Noah Semblist here to share places of a present past about the historiographical impulse in art practice. Noah is a good friend to many of us here tonight, and I think I speak for all when I say he makes us very proud as a serious and ambitious scholar. And when I say that, I mean a scholar in every aspect of his own practice as a curator, a writer, an artist, and chair and associate professor of art at SMU. Noah has equipped himself well for the pursuit of his various endeavors with personal research, travel, and experience, as well as an MA and BA from Hampshire College, an MFA from the University of Washington, and a PhD in art history from UT Austin. He has contributed to Art Journal, Modern Painter, Art Papers, Art Lies, Art Pulse, and Art 21 Plus. His dissertation, Digging Through Time, Psychogeographies of Occupation, focused on ways that contemporary artists in Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon address history. He edited the book Places of a Present Past, published by New York Publication Studio in 2015, contributed to Beyond the Aesthetic and the Anti-Aesthetic by University Press 2013, Public Servants, Art and the Crisis of the Common Good, New Museum and MIT Press 2016, and is in the process of editing a volume about Tanya Bruguera's The Francis Effect, a project co-produced by the Guggenheim Museum, the Santa Monica Museum of Art, and SMU. As some of us learned with Lena Katzoff's presentation a few weeks ago, Noah curated False Flags with Pelican Baum in New Orleans in 2016, which included public movement, the group Lena is affiliated with and the topic of her Tuesday evening presentation. Other curatorial projects include emergency measures at Power Station in 2015, Tammy Ben-Tor at Test Site in 2012, Out of Place at Laura Reynolds Gallery in 2011, Queer States at the Visual Arts Center in Austin in 2011, Yuri's Office by Eve Sussman and Rufus Corporation at Fort Worth Contemporary Arts in 2010. And he was on the curatorial team for the 2013 Texas Biennial. In 2016, Noah was the co-curator and co-producer for New City's Future Ruins, a convening that invited artists, designers, and thinkers to reimagine and engage the extreme urbanism of America's Western Sunbelt. All to say, an impressive career that has faithfully followed genuine interest, which is, to my mind, the greatest sign of success. I could go on and on, but I'm going to end this introduction with a final announcement and a request. Today is Noah Semblist's birthday. And since he's been kind enough to agree to spend it with us, instead of welcoming him with an applause, I would like for everybody to join me in singing happy birthday. So I am going to step away from the mic for everybody's sake, and I'm going to count to three. Are we ready? One, two, three.
Happy birthday. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thanks to John Knuckles, thanks to Michael Moore, and thanks to Terry for everything. This This series here has been really fantastic. I mean, I think as Terry mentioned, Alina Katsov, who's involved with public movement, was someone that I was very closely involved with in terms of collaborating on a project in New Orleans. And Ray Anastas, who was just here talking about Orchard, is someone that I have collaborated on with a class, actually, that was at SMU about that project. And this is just an amazing series with incredible artists. Alina mentioned sort of standing here at the same place that Andrea Fraser had, like, wept through an entire talk about an amazing sculptor. This is an amazing opportunity that I think since I've been here in 2003 has been an amazing gift. And it's something that's super important. So, yes, let's do it. My practice in general is a little complicated. Some people get up here and sort of will give a talk sort of like, this is who I am, this is what I do. And this is not really that. This is kind of a fragment of that. As Terry mentioned, my background is as an artist. I occasionally return to that as a practice, but primarily have functioned as an artist, writer, and curator, and teacher. And at the center of that really is a kind of research that has been really targeted towards certain key things that I was really working on as an artist. And that research often involves, as Terry mentioned, travel and dialogue. Like, I basically spend a lot of my time talking to people to try to dig a little deeper to figure out what's going on. So even the present tense of that statement makes it seem like I'm trying to figure out what's happening now. But what this talk is really about is how we figure out what's happening now in relationship to history, how we figure out how artists negotiate with the traces and remnants of history. So this lecture is about artists dealing with places that hold traces of a past trauma. The artists that I'm going to discuss act as historians, but these artists as historians are less interested in the truth than the way that we feel through the legacies of past traumas. They reveal the oblique ways that we repress historical trauma, burying it in the very sites of their origin. These works are filled with an archaeological ethic, metaphorically digging down both spatially and psychologically into the depths of transnational grief. So I'm going to weave together three projects from the past few years. So Terry mentioned all of them. One is Places of a Present Past, a publication that included three exhibitions at the Pollock Gallery at SMU. A second is a kind of compacted version of the dissertation I did as a part of my PhD at UT that dealt with art and politics in Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon. And then the third is talking about New Cities, Future Ruins, which is a four-year project that looks at the emergent crisis of urbanism in the Southwest Sunbelt states and their relationship to other international analogs. So this is an image from the film Hiroshima Mon Amour, which is a 1959 film directed by Alain René, who's also very much known for his film Night and Fog, which was in 1955 that dealt with the Holocaust. In this film, one character states, quote, "You've seen nothing in Hiroshima," unquote. This statement follows a montage of the horrific effects of nuclear bombing on the flesh of its survivors, suggesting that this record of suffering is not an experience of the suffering itself. I was actually reminded of this film by Waleed Raj, who Terry and I had actually worked together to bring here to DFW, who, when he came to SMU, had actually started a lecture with this image talking about Hiroshima Mon Amour because, as a Lebanese artist whose work has dealt with the aftermath of the Lebanon Civil War, he was thinking about how other previous incarnations of grief have been represented. The Lebanese theorist Jalal Tufik has noted that during and after the Lebanon Civil War, Lebanese citizens were indifferent to the documentation of carnage in film and photography because they became habituated to destruction. This skepticism about documentary film and photography raises a crucial question about the representation of not only history in general, but in particular the histories of drama. Working through trauma often involves repetition compulsion and melancholia, which is holding on to the most difficult moments in our memories. What I'm going to be arguing here tonight is that through dialogical practice, which is a sort of academic term that essentially means engaging in conversation, that we can work past melancholia to a deeper and more resolved form of mourning. So the first project is this book, Places of a Present Past, that was a way to wrap together three exhibitions that dealt with the histories of trauma. We had a curator that was working at the Pollock Gallery, Sally Frader, who had pitched a couple of exhibitions. I wanted to work on an exhibition, and all three of them were really lined up in this thematic way, and it seemed a little bit odd to do show after show that seemed to be so related. So it seemed to do it in a more intentional way, and to wrap it together with a publication would actually make it more of a cycle of exhibitions than three that were maybe too closely related. So I worked with a group called Publication Studio, which started in Portland, Oregon. But this studio was actually based in Hudson. And what it was doing was a book that was pulling together exhibitions that in many ways geographically would seem to be really dispersed, one having to do with Japan and Korea, another having to do with Germany, and a third having to do with Israel-Palestine. One of the things about Publication Studio that's really unique is that it's essentially artisanal print on demand, right? Like it's a publication company that really was started out of frustration with the constant machine of the publication industry to have to produce so many books, to constantly struggle to sell enough. And what it was based on was really thinking in a more intentional way about publication in relationship to readership, and readership in relationship to dialogue, and dialogue as a way to construct a kind of active community. So as a part of the publication, by design, were these three events. So basically, I took it to New York, where one of the artists was based, to do a conversation with him in Brooklyn, also to Vancouver, where another artist was based, Jin Miyun, and to Rotterdam, which also had another publication studio outpost at a design museum there. So the first exhibition that was curated by Sally Frader was Sarah Morris's 1972. It's basically a video in relationship to a series of prints and also a series of paintings. We basically just showed the video and the prints. The subject matter has to do with the 1972 Olympics in Munich, which famously involved the group Black September, which was a Palestinian group that had taken hostage 11 Israeli athletes and eventually killed them. One of the things that's interesting to me about this event is that Black September is the name of this group. It refers to a 1970 massacre of the PLO in Jordan, which eventually led to the PLO's moving from Jordan to Lebanon, which is something that I'll come back to later. So that complicates a history that seems to be much more rooted in Germany's history itself. Germany, when it was staging the 1972 Olympics, was in many ways trying to get beyond the memories of the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. So these are two stills from Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia, a film from 1958. What Sarah Morris is really trying to do is to use a vision of modernist design to transcend this past, right? To show how Germany was really trying to look at a kind of progressive modernism, was really trying to move on from Nazism. But one of the things that's inherent in this past is to think about three intersecting lines of histories. Number one is the Jewish-Israeli history, which is tied to a couple of dates. One, the Holocaust, leading to 1948 when the State of Israel was established, and later 1972 when the Munich Olympics occurred, bringing to collision Israel, Palestine, and Germany once again. Also, Palestinian history is implicit in this. 1948, which is the beginning of the Palestinian exile, what Palestinians called the Nakba, or the catastrophe. 1967, the war that resulted in the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And 1970, which is the date that Black September, as a name of the group, represents. In 1972, this moment in Munich. And then also German history, which is World War II, the 1960s student movement, and 1972. So what Sarah Morris does is she tracks this mostly through two things: a series of tracking shots that are that are looking over the design of the stadium, and also this talking head interview with Georg Sieber, who was a psychologist who was hired as a consultant for Olympic security. In this interview, he talks a lot about the work that he had done with the SDS, this leftist student group in the 1960s. And he was very proud of this way of German policing being essentially nonviolent to be able to control a situation, as opposed to a kind of totalitarian fascist overt violence to control a population. But one of the things, as the story evolves, is that he had said that this was his plan for the 1972 Olympics, but as the events unfolded with the hostage crisis, that ultimately Germany's failed attempt at using nonviolence as a way of controlling a violent situation led to a political struggle that ceded authority to the security to Israel. And once Israel controlled the situation, he says it got out of control. And through his narrative, he also, at one moment, kind of breaks down. He's a very measured man. And at one moment, he lights a cigarette. And as he's smoking about it, he complains about the quote-unquote Arab mentality that destroyed the process and ultimately led to the violence. So as the film basically shows one narrative of this history, there are also these prints that were reproduced in the book and also in the exhibition that correspond. And it seems like a time code, essentially saying, like, at this moment this happens, at this moment this happens, a structure that would seem to be a reliable sequence of events. But the structure is completely reordered, and as a result, it confuses the spectator and also questions the truth of the telling of history. So this is a strategy that a lot of artists use in relationship to history, questioning sort of the authority of the historian. But in today's moment, we're a moment of alternative facts, which harkens back also to, say, like the Colbert Report's truthiness during the Bush administration, or even further back to Foucault's Archaeology of Knowledge, which basically was questioning the ideology of history. One thing that I am proposing is that this artist and a lot of the artists that I'm dealing with are not saying that there is no truth in the way that history is told, but rather to be aware of the various ways that ideology functions within it, and to be skeptical and to analyze it, but that there could actually be a truth that exists within it. So this is a spread that existed within the book. It was divided between these three exhibitions, but at the same time had an interview between, it was basically a conversation between me and Sally Frater, the curator of the two other exhibitions. I had curated a show called Where Are You From, which included three artists, Kamal Al-Jafri, Aissa Dibi, and Dorgez. These are three artists who are what could be referred to as 1948 Palestinians. In 1948, as I mentioned, there was a war that established the State of Israel. I also mentioned that Palestinians refer to this as the Nakba, or the catastrophe. This is when 750,000 Palestinians went into exile. Of those who did not leave, of those who were not sent into exile, those who remained, those who decided to remain, were given citizenship. Were given citizenship in the State of Israel. This is a long, complex thing that we don't have time to go into here. But the status of the 1948 Palestinian was essentially what this exhibition was looking at. In particular, looking at three cities, the cities of Jaffa or Yaffa, or Lod or Alid. I'm intentionally using basically sort of the Hebrew word for this or the Arabic word for these places, and a third, Haifa. This is a still from one of the artists, Aissa Dibi, called The Trial. It was a video installation, two-channel video installation, that was originally shown at the Venice Biennial in 2013. It was based on the trial of Daoud Turki, who was a Palestinian-Israeli communist who was put on trial because he went along with a group of Jewish-Israeli communists to Syria. He was put on trial for espionage and treason, and he gave a speech in his own defense at this trial, which basically was a speech that was defending his communism in relationship to the Palestinian struggle, which is distinct from a kind of Palestinian nationalism, right? His position was one that was against Zionism, but also against Palestinian nationalism, because in essence, his and many communists at the time were arguing against and all forms of nationalism that were associated with capitalism, and looking at this kind of horizontal approach that would be looking for class struggle regardless of one's national origin. The title of this piece, The Trial, also refers to Kafka's famous novel and really refers to a kind of absurdity, an absurdity to the trial, an absurdity to the Palestinian position. And this absurdity for Aissa Dibi, the artist who created this video, was also reflected in the way that the video unfolds. There are a number of actors who, on stage, you can see here that they're wearing these red shirts with the words revolution that are printed on them. And they keep on trying to read his speech again and again and again. And each time they try to read it, they're interrupted. People come through dropping down cups of water, cups of coffee. They interrupt each other. So the kind of the great arc of revolutionary rhetoric is constantly cut off. And they try to go through it all four times, and each time it's never completed. So in essence, for Aissa, a Palestinian artist who lived in Cairo at the time that he was filming this, lived through the Tahrir Square revolution, a revolution that we now know, and even then when he was filming this, was also seen as being doomed to failure. It's a critique also of revolutionary rhetoric. So this is not a typical kind of Palestinian political art that would be simply critical of the occupation or simply sort of advocating for the Palestinian position, but also neither is it actually a kind of laudatory advocacy for a kind of communist struggle that Daoud Turki himself was advocating for, but rather it was something that was really questioning the possibilities of revolutionary struggle actually being completed and actually succeeding in any way. There's a hidden signification of this failure in the film. This table, which basically this was filmed in Haifa, where Aissa Dibi grew up, a town that's in the north of Israel. This table, where all the drama occurs, is in this theater, in a black box theater in Haifa, and was this table was actually used to hold the body of Juliano Merkamis, who was a half-Palestinian, half-Jewish founder of the Freedom Theater in Jenin, who was assassinated by mass gunmen in 2011. Dibi's work was not only about Palestinian revolution and activism, but his experience of the revolution in Cairo was really inherent in this, and also thinking about sort of the larger questions of the Arab Spring. The second artist in this exhibition was Dor Gez, who's half Christian Palestinian, half Jewish Tunisian Israeli, who makes work that sort of grows out of this hybrid identity. And it included, we included a number of works, including these photographs, Dor calls scanograms, which are photographs that are related to a film called 40 Days, which was about a series of destroyed grave sites of Palestinian Christians in Lod, which is a town just outside of Tel Aviv. In one scene of the video that was included in the exhibition 40 Days, his grandmother shows these photographs. She basically calls for Dor. She asks, Dor's interviewing her, and he says, "Can you show me the photographs?" And she says, "Oh, they're in the kitchen in this drawer." So he goes to find them, and they're all in a wadded stack that's gotten wet. And so he hands the stack to her, and as she's trying to show him the photographs that are documentation that they used to show the police that these grave sites had been, of his family, had been desecrated, she rips them apart to be able to show him what had happened. So that kind of ripping apart of something that seems very mundane, these are 3x5 photographs that we use ultimately as kind of police evidence, also become a kind of violence that occurs to an archive of the history of a people that is still exists in a displaced condition. But one of the things here that I just wanted to point out is that the way the photograph is being used. A photograph, as I mentioned, could be something that's a document of history, but a photograph is something that also is used not just as a document that exists outside of any kind of human contact. A document is something that often is pointed to over the course of a conversation. Another work that we included was a video called Watermelons Under the Bed, where it's basically a documentation of his relationship with his grandfather, Jacob Menayer, who keeps watermelons under the bed out of a kind of tradition, a folk myth, that says that essentially by keeping them under the bed, they keep cold, they keep longer, but they also ripen slowly and they taste better. These stories from his father about these things that he learned, you know, from his father and his father's father about how to keep watermelons, that also show his daily life, kind of in bed, getting up, making coffee, cutting up the watermelon for his grandson Dor, are intercut with other stories that about him growing up in Israel-Palestine post-1948 and the various things that he did to assimilate into an Israeli society. A second artist that was included is Kamal Al-Jafari, who is a filmmaker who told a story that's also a kind of personal memoir about his family's history in the town of Jaffa, also not too far from Tel Aviv. This is his uncle on the right, that's Kamal Jafri on the left, and he's telling him stories about the history of this bustling port. Jaffa was historically a port city in Palestine, and what he's pointing to are essentially other examples of the rusted out hulls of boats that you can see behind them, which become signs of the sort of decaying, unused history of Palestinian existence. There are other signals that are quite different that exist within this film. This is a scene of him in Tel Aviv in a skyscraper listening to an audio guide about the history of Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is known as the White City. It's known as a city that embraced modernity and is a symbol of economic and cultural progress, which sits right next to the historic city of Jaffa. But a lot of this film is filled with his family sitting by windows and staring at them. There are long stretches of silence. There's a question, there's a sense within this film as if these people are waiting, sitting and waiting for something. And I've always thought about the waiting that occurs within this film in relationship to a lot of Palestinians who essentially are waiting for a kind of stability, a kind of sovereignty, a structure of dedicated human rights, whether that's through a Palestinian nation or some other solution. Another notion is that they're waiting for the right of return, they're waiting for the end of the occupation, but in many ways they're waiting for the end of what exists now. The third artist in this in the publication, the third exhibition, was a solo show also curated by Sally Frater, by the artist Jin Mi-yoon. Jin Mi is an artist based in Vancouver who makes these performance videos of her crawling on the ground in a series of sites. This is called As It Is Becoming, the Atomic Center in Onsen. This is basically in Hiroshima. And one of the things that Jinmi was very interested in, she is of Korean descent, even though she lives in Canada, and was very interested in the Korean-Japanese relationship, which is fraught. At the time of the bombing of Hiroshima, there were 80,000 Koreans who were living there. And as a result of the bombing, 20,000 Koreans died. So as she's doing this crawl, this sort of performative gesture that's recorded in this video, what she's doing is sort of calling attention to this site in relationship to that history. And not just a history of the bombing of Hiroshima, but a kind of recovered history of the bombing of Hiroshima in relationship to the Korean national identity. One of the things that she talks about is that many of the survivors from Hiroshima who were Korean citizens who were living in Hiroshima at the time returned to Korea because they weren't allowed to seek treatment in Japan after the bombings. This is a still from a video of hers called As It Is Becoming in Beppu Japan Park, which is a former U.S. Army base. This area was once the site of a spa that was used to service U.S. Army officers during World War II and was spared during the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this is a still from a piece called The Dreaming Collective Knows No History, U.S. Embassy to Japanese Embassy in Seoul. So as you can see, there's sort of U.S. histories, Japanese histories, Korean histories that are intersecting here. And in essence, it's a history of U.S. colonialism and Japanese colonialism in relationship to Korean history. And this history is signified through a kind of prostration, right? The horizontality of her performance is quite different than the verticality of everyone else that's walking around her. She was very influenced in thinking about Walter Benjamin's Arcades project, the notion of the flaneur, the one who sort of walks through the city with a certain kind of freedom that traces the designs that exist in an urban fabric, the civic space of modernity, and also an urbanism that hides the past, that hides its past because of modernity. And also specifically in a post-war condition where there's an erasure of traditional forms of design. Okay, part two. So as I mentioned, you know, through these three projects, really there's always the question of how artists are dealing with history. I spent, as Terry mentioned, a number of years researching and writing about a dissertation about art and politics in Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon, specifically the way that artists act as historians, artists act as archaeologists. The term in the title, Psychogeographies, refers to the Situationist International, a group in the 1950s working in France in alignment with a lot of progressive politics. Guy Debord defined psychogeography as, quote, the study of the precise laws and specific effects of the geographical environment, whether consciously organized or not, on the emotions and behavior of individuals, unquote. So one of my questions, thinking about this term and this practice, was how does this study reveal the effects of a geography whose sovereignty is contested? So that's the question of the psychogeography in relationship to occupation. So it was divided into four parts. The first was ancient history, thinking about the way that ancient history of Israel-Palestine functions in terms of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The second was the Holocaust. The third was the 1948 war. And the fourth was the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. So I'm going to talk about it slightly out of sync, and hopefully it'll make a little sense. So again, this is out of order, but also just a sample. So these are two stills of work by the artist Yael Bartana, an Israeli artist who's now based in Berlin, And she had, did a trilogy of videos called And Europe Will Be Stunned that premiered at the 2011 Venice Biennale in the Polish Pavilion. So it was an Israeli artist of Polish descent who was representing Poland in the Venice Biennale, which, you know, within the context of biennial exhibitions already is sort of intervening in the way that nationalism functions with these international exhibitions. The first in the trilogy was a video called Mari Koszmary, and on the left you can see a still from that where a character who is half real, half fiction. His real name is Sławomir Sirokowski, who is actually a journalist, an activist, who gives a speech in a Warsaw stadium that is calling for 3 million Jews to return to their true homeland. One thing to note is that at the time of this statement or this performance, that this is the same number of Palestinians that exist in Jordan, the West Bank, Gaza, Syria, and Lebanon. So by implication, the vacuum of the Jews who exist within Israel would give way for Palestinians to fill that vacuum. The second still over there is from a video that was basically a kibbutz that was built on the site of the Warsaw Ghetto. So in essence, this group of Israeli Jews heed the call from Sławomir Sirokowski, who basically come back dressed as pioneers, Israeli pioneers from the 1930s and 40s, who typically would have built these kibbutzim, the sort of communal settlements in Palestine and State of Israel. But this time, essentially, rather than settling within Palestine, they're settling a return back to Poland. And you can see examples of them teaching each other to translate from Hebrew to Polish, which is a typical thing, that essentially Polish immigrants would be taught Hebrew as they arrived to the emergent state of Israel. So what Bartana does is she imagines this as a group called the Jewish Renaissance Movement in Poland, or the JRMIP. And there's a manifesto that says many things, but it ends, we want to return, we want to heal our mutual trauma. With one religion, one cannot listen. With one color, one cannot see. With one color, we cannot feel. Without you, we can't even remember. One of the things that this is the voice is speaking to is speaking basically back and forth between Polish society and a Jewish society, and in particular a Jewish Israeli society. One of the things that Bartana was also dealing with is not just thinking about a Polish past in relationship to a contemporary Jewish Israeli present, and by implication, a contemporary Palestinian present. It's also thinking about the ways that the current conditions of Polish society are also fraught with questions of immigration and fraught with questions of homogeneity in terms of race, in terms of religion, in terms of a particular notion of national identity, which is something that has very much to do not just with Poland, but with the EU in general. So the next step after this trilogy of films premiered in Venice was she was invited to the Berlin Biennial, and she decided to hold a congress for the Jewish Renaissance Movement in Poland that in many ways referenced the first Zionist Congress that was established by Zionists to plan for the future state of Israel. So this is a trailer for that congress.
3.3 million Jews can change the life of 40 million Poles. How should the EU change in order to welcome the other? How should Poland change within a reimagined EU? How should Israel change to become part of the Middle East?
Join us together with international delegates at the first Congress of the Jewish Renaissance Movement in Poland to address and answer these questions. The founding wish of the JRMIP is to write new pages into a history that never quite took the course we wanted. We reach back to the past in order to shape our way forward. Together, we can create a new reality, drawing on the strength of our imagination. Join us to raise your voice. Join us, and Europe will be stunned.
So the Congress occurred. People came. The Congress was set up in a historic theater in Berlin. It had a series of delegates, and the delegates were assigned to propose and then debate various resolutions for the Jewish Renaissance movement in Poland to take up for the future. So this is in 2012 at the Berlin Biennial, and the first of these proposals was actually brought by Galit Eilat, who's an Israeli curator. And her proposal was for all profits from Holocaust tourism in Poland to go to rehabilitate Gaza, Rwanda, Congo, South Sudan, and other countries that have suffered in the wake of Western colonialism. One of the participants commented that the profits should not only come from the fees collected at Auschwitz-Birkenau, but also the profits of Hollywood movies about the Holocaust. But one delegate, Michal Zarada, objected to Eilat's proposal because he argued that the notion of a Holocaust industry is anti-Semitic because it echoes the assumption that the Holocaust is merely a way for Jews to make money. The Palestinian curator Reem Fada replied that Holocaust tourism, like Israeli youth groups' trips to Auschwitz, reinscribes the notion of Jewish victimhood, which is the basis of Israel's occupation of Palestine. Finally, the proposal was put to a vote. 49 voted yes, and 11 voted no. But of course, these results are imaginary, right? This is a parafictional group. It's a group that isn't necessarily going to have any real impact on, say, the profits from Hollywood movies about the Holocaust or the profits that come from various tourist groups going to Auschwitz-Birkenau. But one of the things that one of the phrases in this trailer is actually talking about the power of the imaginary, and the power of the political imaginary, and the power of the political imaginary actually being manifest in real life. A second project that actually was featured in the same Berlin Biennial was the Key of Return. It was a project by the that was organized primarily by the Palestinian artist Khaled Urani, who's quite famous in many regards. He also organized a project called Picasso in Palestine that was in the last Documenta. But he was working together with activists and also a curator based in Amman. But in many ways, you know, the curator of the Berlin Biennial at the time was Artur Zmijewski. Artur Zmijewski is an artist, a Polish artist, who's very well known for very provocative projects, one of which includes him asking for a Jewish Holocaust survivor to refresh his tattoo, as he puts it. So the entire video occurs within a tattoo parlor where he's like redoing the numbers of the tattoo that he's had since the Holocaust. So he is a provocateur, and in many ways, when he invited a number of artists, which also included the Occupy movement and a lot of other activists, when he's inviting an artist like Khaled Urani and a group of activists to bring the key, he's trying to provoke a set of relationships. So this is a photograph of the key at the Aida camp just outside of Bethlehem. It's a refugee camp of Palestinians. And you can see the UN office, because these camps actually exist under United Nations administration. The key itself, this key was this huge key that was originally made by artisans and activists to symbolize this very, very common symbol the Palestinians use, which is the key of the lost home. There's many, many stories that Palestinians in 1948 will tell you of sort of being forced to leave their homes. They thought that they were just leaving for a little bit. They might have taken a bag of clothes. They lock their house. They go with their family, thinking that in a couple days the problems will be over and they'll be able to come back. But the people who live in this camp are multiple generations that never did. And in most of their houses, they'll have a key that's actually on their wall that is a symbol of the home that they hope to return to. So as a part of this project, they take the key from the camp, they put it on a ship, and then they bring it to Berlin, and then they center it in the KV in Berlin, and it's centered there as a as an art object. But it's also a conversation piece. There was this elaborate event that that occurred when it was actually placed there, where a number of Palestinian refugees and their descendants who live in Germany sort of spoke about the key, spoke about its significance for Palestinian history. But in many ways, I really think that for Zmijewski, this wasn't just about the key itself. This wasn't about the key as a symbol for Palestinian struggle. In many ways, the placement of the key at the center of Berlin was also similar to what occurred within Sarah Morris's film. It was sort of putting together sort of historical lines, looking at the relationship between the Holocaust, Jewish refugees, the State of Israel, and Palestinian refugees, and seeing how these things could be related. But in many ways, the use of the key and the use of the term the Nakba to think about the tragedy of the Palestinian experience today is something that is also contested within a lot of Palestinian artists and activists today. An alternative in many ways to the Key of Return as a project by Palestinians is a project called Campus in Camps, which is run by Alessandro Petti and Sandy Hilal, just outside of Bethlehem. And this project really is thinking about the camps. Remember, this key and the camp are sort of linked together. That the camp, in many ways, is often thought of from what you see on the left, a series of tents, this kind of very temporary refugee experience. But today the camps exist on the much closer to what you see on the right. They exist as cities. They exist as cities with multiple generations that have their own sort of social and economic and cultural life. This is a collage that essentially puts together a 1948 and a current day notion of the refugee camp. So Campus in Camps is an alternative university that really is thinking of itself as a design lab to rethink the camp. So to rethink the camp is not just to sort of address its utilitarian goals, right? Like how to create the best kind of public space, how to create the best way to use water, how to have the most kind of ecological sustainability or social sustainability. It's also a way of readdressing the camp itself by definition. So if the camp is thought of as something that can never truly develop, because to develop it is to admit the failure of return, then that means that the camp has to constantly exist in a kind of stasis, right? A kind of stunted development that can never truly address some of its kind of most pressing needs. And in many ways, what Campus in Camps is trying to do, not just by looking at design solutions, but also thinking more theoretically about the very notion of the camp, the very notion of the refugee, the very notion of nationalism itself, perhaps they can come up with another way to move beyond the more traditional ways that the Nakba is defined. So often this is based on conversations. These are seminars with local scholars, invited scholars, that are talking about questions like refugees, urbanism, the commons, what is a public, what is participation, or questions of sustainability. So a second group of projects that I was focusing on that have to do with ancient history, specifically the question of archaeology, focus around this one film by Avi Mugurbi, an Israeli filmmaker, specifically his film called Avenge But One of My Two Eyes. This film focuses primarily on a site called Matsada, very famous, that it's very famous for the following story. According to Josephus Flavius, following the destruction of the second Jewish temple in 70 CE, a group of Jewish rebels called the Sicarii set up camp in this site, originally built by King Herod of the Roman Empire as a palace and fortress. They used it as a base for rebel attacks against the Romans, the Roman occupiers, and in 72 CE, the Roman governor surrounded Masada, laying siege to the encampment. The Romans built a ramp to reach the walls of Masada and used a battering ram to enter the fortress, but when they arrived, they found all 936 inhabitants had committed mass suicide. This site has become central to the myth of Jewish heroism that's embedded within the state of Israel. The story of Masada involved the overwhelming force of a Roman army and a scrappy group of Jewish rebel fighters. This image represented the historic persecution of Jews for which the state of Israel would be an antidote. But this instance of Jewish heroism was also a countermyth to the passive victimhood of Jews of the Holocaust. In many ways, archaeology in general, not just at Masada, is a crucial part of thinking about the evolution of Zionism. It's proof of the Jewish right to a historic relationship to this place. It's also a use of science and fact in relationship to that, and in particular the notion of facts on the ground, which is a term that's usually used in relationship to settlements, but can also be used historically to think about past building in relationship to archaeology. So one of the things that this film focuses on a lot are the tour guides that exist on Masada. And you see a number of tour guides that are bringing around Jewish youth groups from the US, the UK, Israelis, Israeli military groups who are there for educational experiences. And they say things like this: imagine you're a Jew in 72 AD, surrounded by Romans, much like we are surrounded by the Arabs today. What would you do? They're all of these role-playing exercises that are meant to be cited specifically in that space. So this is intercut with these moments that were occurring for the filmmaker. This is him in his studio filming himself talking on the phone to a Palestinian friend. This is during the Second Intifada, Intifada meaning uprising. It would take a little bit too long to go into what that was and why that happened, but essentially during the Second Intifada, Avi Mogherbi is on the phone talking to a Palestinian friend who's in the Palestinian town of Jenin in the West Bank during what was referred to by not only Palestinians, Israelis, and the international press as the Siege of Jenin. And he's talking, they're having this conversation about sort of the ancient and contemporary examples of military siege. And by implication, what starts to occur is there's this kind of intercutting back and forth between these stories of tour guides on Masada and this conversation with his Palestinian friend. In essence, he flips the metaphor, right? So in Masada, the occupying power who is laying siege to this scrappy band of revolutionaries are the Romans surrounding the Jews. But in this case, during Jenin, it is essentially Israelis that are surrounding Palestinians. So the fourth chapter dealt with an artist named Akram Sattari that I published just recently in an Israeli-based magazine called Tohu. And the piece was translated into both Hebrew and Arabic. It centers on this one video installation by Akram Sattari, a Lebanese artist, called Letter to a Refusing Pilot. It was shown in Venice in 2013 in the Lebanon Pavilion, and it included mostly this video installation. You can see this chair, which you'll see from the back, and also a film installation that focused primarily on a kind of scanning 16 millimeter film that's scanning over this footage. This footage is a photo collage that Akram made in 1982 during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon when he was 16 years old learning photography. He basically wanted to borrow his dad's camera and learn photography and what was outside. this was what he saw from his balcony. So this film is predicated on a story. It's a rumor that occurred during this invasion. The rumor went like this, as he heard it, that there was this Israeli pilot, an Air Force pilot, who was sent to bomb this one school. Well, he was sent to bomb a building. As he gets closer to the building, he starts to identify the building, and he thinks it's either a hospital or a school, and he says, "Are you sure this is the hideout of, you know, these militants that we're supposed to be bombing?" And, you know, the guy at the other end of the line says, "Yes, we're sure, this is exactly what's happening." And as it happens, the pilot, you know, is there in reserve duty, so he's actually a practicing professional, he's an architect. And so he recognizes the layout as necessarily being either a school or a hospital. So what he does is the pilot decides not to bomb it, veers off into the Mediterranean, and drops his three bombs into the Mediterranean. He basically refused to bomb it because he thought it was a school. So as it turns out, there was truth to this rumor. So my process involved basically going to Venice to see the installation, then going to Beirut to interview the artist, and then going to Tel Aviv to find the pilot, who is now an architect. So the architect's name is Chagai Tamir, and what they told me was a story that essentially evolved like this. Through a mutual friend, they figured out that Akram had basically published something in a book that told this story as a rumor, as an offhanded thing. This historian, who was an American historian, actually found it at the Arab Image Foundation in Beirut and said, "Oh my goodness, I know this guy." Because he also was basically, he was an historian who was looking at the history of the Israeli-Lebanon war and had been going back and forth between Beirut and Tel Aviv. One day he was in line in Tel Aviv at the grocery store, and a woman says, "Who are you? What's going on?" Because that's often what happens in grocery stores in Tel Aviv. And he says, "Oh, I'm an historian." He's like, "Oh, what are you writing on?" "Oh, the 1982 war." And she said, "Oh, you should meet my husband. He was a pilot during that war." So basically, she invites him back, and they eventually become good friends. So this guy who showed up in Beirut reading this book, seeing this story about this rumor, said, "Oh, I know that guy, and that's true." So he then connected the two of them via email, and the artist Akram and the architect Chagai start this email correspondence. Akram starts sending him his video work, explaining who he is as an artist. Akram eventually invites Chagai to meet in Rome in a hotel to stay for a few days just to talk. So for these 3 days, they meet in the lobby of the hotel every day, and Akram had asked Chagai to bring some photographs from his childhood. And this is what they do, kind of like the image of that video of Dorgez, where they're sort of like pointing to the photograph and talking about it. The photographs become a way to discuss their position in relationship to their upbringing, a personal upbringing that also has all of these cultural and national resonances. So this conversation basically evolves into this project once Akram is invited to be a part of the Lebanon Pavilion in Venice. And he makes this video, but one thing actually sticks for Chagai. There's one piece in one of Akram's works that he actually had a real difficulty with. It was a piece that that actually involved quotations from propaganda from the Second Intifada. Akram was on this email list that was looking for Palestinian solidarity during this. And this image flashed on the screen for a minute. Not even a minute, like 2 seconds. Which is basically the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, dressed up as a Nazi. And this for Chagai was basically going too far. This was a moment where the ghost of the Holocaust came in and intervened into the potential for true open dialogue, for a sense of mutual trust to be built between these two people who are citizens of countries at war. I mean, when they were engaging this in this conversation, they had to necessarily go to Rome. There's no border crossing. There's no flights back and forth. There's no postal service. You had to go to a third space. So when I traveled back and forth there, I had to use two passports. I had to hide the other one to make sure that in each place they didn't know where I was coming from. And I had to fly through Istanbul. Because there's no possibility for direct connection. So they had already transcended that. They had gotten that far. They had gone all the way to get to the third place to have the conversation of two citizens of nations at war that could actually build a relationship. But this image in an artwork that was an appropriation of propaganda that was meant to think about the way that propaganda functions stuck in the craw of the architect Haggai in such a way that he basically couldn't build enough empathy and trust for this other person. So another conversation that Akram was involved with was with a filmmaker named Avi Mugurbi, who I mentioned earlier in relationship to the Matsada film, Avenged But One of My Two Eyes. So Avi and Akram were at this residency together in Paris, and they were doing an onstage performance, a performative conversation between the two of them. And this conversation was about their two memories of childhood, of growing up in their mutual nations. And that performance was recorded in this book. This is the book that the historian found in the Arab Image Foundation in Beirut that told that story. And in this book, they say different things. So like one story is that Avi Mugurbi says, "I remember being a soldier in that war. And I was in a tank brigade, and I was in the tank, and I was it was my job to be at the machine gun turret looking out for snipers. And I see this kid with a camera come out onto his balcony." And Akram says, "I remember this story where I was taking those same pictures, and I looked down, and there's this guy in a tank who almost shot me, but I went inside at the last minute." So, but Avi then goes further and says, "You know, I have these photographs of my family. This is my father," Avi says. "That's him with his gun in his pants. And that what he's holding up is a number in front of a Palestinian that had just been found. Avi's father worked in the Irgun, which was the kind of paramilitary group that eventually became the Israeli military once the state was established in 1948. So he was just telling a story about his family. These are family pictures. But this is also a family photo, which is his family in Beirut in 1934. This is Avi Mugurbi, the Israeli's family, in Beirut in 1934. Because Avi Mugurbi, yes, is Jewish, Israeli, but his family goes back to living pre-1948 State of Israel as Jews in Palestine for generations. And pre-1948, it was quite common for Jews to actually move between places like Cairo, Beirut, and Damascus. So through this conversation, Avi does two things that were quite different than the conversation with Haggai. One thing is that he acknowledges a complicity with a certain kind of violence that is threatening Akram. Second, he is acknowledging that he is a part of a history, a family history, a national history, and a history that could be assumed to exist within binaries of Arab, Jew, Muslim, Jew, Christian, Jew, but actually is much more complex than that if we think prior to our contemporary notions of nationalism. Okay, I'm running a little late, so I'm going to speed through the last portion. This is bringing it back home. So I did this project this past November called New Cities, Future Ruins, that is a project that was initiated by Gavin Krober, who's the artistic director, and Clyde Valentin, who is here tonight. who was the producer of the project, and I functioned as co-curator and co-producer. So New Cities, Future Ruins was really looking at the rapid growth of cities in the Southwest Sunbelt states and thinking about the sustainability of these cities. It was looking at questions like borders and futurism. In particular, we're looking at this region in cities like Dallas, Houston, Phoenix, Albuquerque, Vegas, San Diego, and thinking about these cities that over the last 10 to 15 years have grown exponentially. There's steel and glass and images of the future. There's a neoliberal economy that's about fluidity, low taxes, lax regulation, everybody come here, Toyota, etc. But within that growth, in that explosive growth, what is the sustainability of the situation? What's its ecological sustainability? What's its social sustainability? And what's its economic sustainability? This region is also defined by borders, borders like San Diego, Tijuana, and El Paso, Juarez, and a border that creates social conditions of immigration and also social conditions in terms of economies. One of the things that interests me as like a little bridge between these is the way the borders function in terms of Israel-Palestine, say like the wall that exists between the West Bank and Israel proper, and the fact that it's actually an Israeli security company that was contracted to provide security for portions of this wall. This is a photograph by Michael Light, who's included in one of the exhibitions. And thematically, what this work, this is a work that was shot at Black Mountain in Las Vegas, that until 2008 was one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. This site was a site that a Hong Kong billionaire had blasted a mountain to create lots for a gated community. But after 2008, the recession left it empty, showing that this is an example of boom and bust capitalism that has both economic, social, and ecological ramifications. The social sustainability of this region is also a thing that we were trying to address, because Dallas, in many ways, we all have the image in our head. We have, you know, in terms of the way that Dallas boosterism functions, more Pritzker Prize-winning architects in one square mile than anywhere in the world. We have a Calatrava Bridge. We're going to have the biggest park. Like, literally, this past week, there was an article about we're going to have the biggest park in the world, bigger than Central Park. Everything's bigger, better, higher, more. But this is also a question, you know, there are also many, many images that exist in Dallas and the cities in the Metroplex that are subject to that growth, where there are a lot of questions about how poor and blighted parts of the city are going to deal with limited city services in relationship to that growth. So what we did is we set up six site-specific installations in an area called Jubilee Park in southeast Dallas. This is a work by Caitlin Berrigan. These works were installed in an empty lot in this neighborhood the night of the election. This work used text and images that were basically about catastrophe. What it provoked was an enormous amount of ire, because in essence, the question was: this election, for many in this neighborhood, was considered a slap in the face, and to actually produce these signs, to visualize that, to embody that, was another slap in the face. So one of the things that we did to address this was to do a lot of really a lot of work in the community, scrambling within the following days to try to bring together some leaders within the community who were very concerned about this. And we had a conversation in the church to talk about the intentions of the project, not just this artist project, which the artist was able to speak to, but the larger project as a whole, and to make sure that as many people in the neighborhood were really feeling engaged with what we were trying to speak to. It was one piece of a larger project that we still need to follow up on. There was also work by Rodrigo Valenzuela, who did photo murals and a video installation that included interviews with undocumented workers. There was a video installation by Lauren Woods, a video essay about Wheatley Place, a utopian African-American planned community in Dallas that was built in the 1920s, that was named after Phyllis Wheatley, the first published African-American poet who was born in West Africa, sold into slavery, and eventually emancipated. It included a group exhibition called Visionary Sprawl with works by Mary Ellen Carroll, the Center for Land Use Interpretation, Michael Light, whose work I showed you earlier, Matthew Moore, and also archival images by Frank Lloyd Wright and Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. There was a night of performances, which included Autumn Night. This was a version of her performance at the MAC. And also a performance by Post Commodity. There also was a kind of, so that was the exhibition performative sort of art portion of it. Then there was a kind of traditional conference aspect, which involved lectures, panels, a Petra Kucha, a keynote speech by Andrew Ross, who is a sociologist who's written a lot about Phoenix and also a lot of activism in relationship to the Gulf with a group called Gulf Labor that we can talk more about if you want. And then also Teddy Cruz and Fona Foreman, who've done a lot of work on the San Diego-Tijuana border. So my main presentation for this was really talking about ruins. Ruins, for me, are a way of thinking about the past that's often a way to represent a number of things. It could represent the horrors of war, death, destruction, displacement, something that should be forgotten. But on the other hand, like paintings like Caspar David Friedrich, the ruin can be romantic, representing a nostalgia for a lost heroic past. And in this sense, the ruin has an aura of authenticity. This is an image of Gaza in Palestine after the 2014 war, but it could also equally be Beirut, Aleppo, Hiroshima, or Dresden. More locally, in the U.S., it could recall even Detroit or New Orleans post-Katrina, places that are produced not by war but social collapse, the product of economic and natural disaster. But it could also be Dallas, Phoenix, or San Diego, potentially in some future. The latest election has reminded us that we live in a fragile social fabric that could tear at any moment. And this, in many ways, was the power of Caitlin Berrigan's images of erupting volcanoes that citizens of Jubilee Park woke up to the day after the election. But how can the ruin be connected to other themes that New City's Future Ruins talked about, like immigration, borders, refugees, and the violence against indigenous communities? And how do we rebuild both present and future ruins? So once again, the origins of what you saw there, an image of a particular military struggle located in Gaza, are rooted back in the war of 1948. This is an image, just like I was showing you earlier, of with campus in camps. This is an image of a refugee camp, Palestinian refugee camp in 1948. The Nakba for many Palestinians signals a time of ruin, of a people and a place, and what Benedict Anderson has called an imagined community that's bounded together by the mourning of a lost moment of destruction. The camp symbolizes this catastrophe and also this hope of return. And this is the ruin that the key of return was meant to signify. So one project to rethink the future of Palestine and potentials for rebuilding is decolonizing architecture that also, similar to Campus and Camps, is run by Sandy Hilal, Alessandro Petti, but also A.L. Weitzman. It's an architecture studio and residency program that's based in Beit Zahur, just outside of Bethlehem, where speculations on the rebuilding after the end of the occupation, after the 2006 withdrawal from Gaza, became the real question. How would Palestinians repurpose settlement architecture? So one thing that they use is reuse, subversion, and subversion of the structures of domination, such as evacuated military bases. This is the hilltop of Ush Grab, which is crow's nest in Arabic. 500 million birds migrate between northern Europe and East Africa and flow through the Jordan Valley. intervention in the revolving door of occupation, Israeli settlers and Palestinian activists. This is a repurposing towards a landing space for bird migration. It's meant to be temporary. It's meant to be symbolic of the migration of refugees. And it gets outside of the binary of Israeli-Palestinian. It's a third group that evokes the nightmare of the Enlightenment, the formlessness of nature taking over the order of a city. Two more slides. A project also by Decolonizing Architecture that's called Al-Fanik, or the Phoenix. It's a project that was started by Decolonizing Architecture that was later taken over by Campus and Camps. The Al-Fanik Center is built on Anton Mountain at the Daesha camp, not far from Bethlehem. It basically signifies layers of destruction between competing powers, the Ottomans, British, Jordanian, Israeli, and Palestinian. From 1948 to 1967, following the 48 War, Jordan used the mountain as a military base. After the 67 War, when Israel occupied the West Bank, it became an Israeli military base. In 1994, following the Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority used it as a police station. In 1997, the Daesha Popular Committee petitioned the Palestinian Authority to use this land to construct housing and a cultural center. In 2002, during the Second Intifada, the Israeli military destroyed the center and once again established it as a military base. In 2005, Israelis withdrew, and it was rebuilt again as a cultural center. This notion of place is what archaeologists call a tell, layers of destruction and rebuilding. So one of the projects that Campus and Camps made in Al-Fanik, in the Phoenix Center, is called the Concrete Tent. It was made in the garden, and it's basically meant to be an image of the refugee and the camp that's positive, that's about planning, that's moving beyond the image of the refugee and the camp associated with poverty, marginalization, victimization. It's something that is built to be permanent, but evokes the history of temporary architecture. So I've evoked a relationship between Israel-Palestine, but also Lebanon, especially through Akam Zatari's work. And one way that I think about cities in the Middle East in relationship to our own is thinking about how Beirut is a city that was utterly destroyed through the civil war that was from 1975 to 1990 is sort of an image of a city that pre-civil war, pre-75, was built as a futuristic hub of cosmopolitan life. So this is a building that was called the Egg, that really is an image of the destruction of a ruined future. And artists like Akram Zatari and Walid Rad are working back through that history and thinking about ways that artists can address memory and trauma. After the Civil War, there was a great rebuilding project and that was run by a development group called Solidaire. And that kind of development, an economic project, was tied to a cultural project of the erasure of a past. The Lebanon Civil War was predicated on sectarian positions that also included Israel, Palestinians, PLO, and Syria. And one of the things that these artists talk about is that in history books in schools, that anything about the war is not taught because no one can agree on what the actual history is. And from a developer's perspective, both public and private interests are to erase the past, to not address it, and to build towards the future. Jalal Tufik, who I mentioned earlier, is an artist, writer, part Palestinian, who was based for many years in Beirut, wrote this, quote, "I, along with my two siblings and my mother, deserted the family apartment during the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Did this make the apartment a ruin? Yes. And not because it was severely damaged and burned during the last days of the offensive. Even after it was restored, it remained a ruin," unquote. The renovated apartment is a copy of what it was before it was deserted and destroyed. But that copy can never be the original, and as a result, always points to its destruction. In this sense, the true ruin is the new building. To illustrate this idea, Tufik tells a story about a vampire in post-war Beirut who's looking for the perfect ruin with the help of a realtor. Goes from one destroyed building to another but can't find the perfect ruin. He's constantly dissatisfied until he finds a brand new building and buys it. The realtor was confused, but at that moment he saw the seemingly young vampire as old and the seemingly new building as a ruin. In this sense, the newly constructed building is haunted by the destruction that led to its construction, its becoming. So how does all this connect to us? We tell ourselves that Gaza, Beirut, and Aleppo are far away, but are occupations and civil wars that far off in the past and in the future? This country is built on genocide of indigenous populations, on slavery, and the ravages of capitalism. There's a resonance with the notion of occupation and land grabs at the service of ideology. And like for Tufik's vampire, this isn't represented with the smoking shell of a burnt-out building. It's signified by the gleaming towers of explosive development. The new cities are built on the ruins of a displaced people. So when we build a place, what is the past that we build on top of? What's the future of this place that we imagine? Is there a future? Is it a future utopia or a future ruin? And how do we have conversations about our past and our collective future? The cities that I talked about so far, Hiroshima, Seoul, Munich, Berlin, Haifa, Bethlehem, Warsaw, Beirut, these places seem so far away and have nothing to do with us, or so we think. But these are two images from U.S. history. The left is a protest for indigenous rights at Standing Rock that occurs today. And on the right is an image of a 1910 lynching in Dallas. And they prove that we have a lot to talk about and a lot that's still unresolved. But I wonder if we can learn from artists and communities elsewhere to reconcile our relationship to this traumatic past. Thanks. Tuba.
I admire you that bring the conversation with the point of view of Palestinians to the table, especially when the rest of the world, and certainly America, is not ignoring them as a nation. I'm just curious if you're having difficulty in America as a moderator bringing this subject to
There is. Yeah, there's a long history of difficulties that artists and curators have encountered with institutions and collectors in Israel. Most of the curatorial work that I do exists outside of large mainstream institutions. And I think that's been an organic process that has occurred for many reasons. I think that this work would be more difficult to do in a larger institution. But on the other hand, I also think that in some cities it's easier than others. Like I think in New Orleans and Dallas, I think it's easier to have these conversations than it is on the East Coast or West Coast. Like Emily Jassir was here not too long ago and I think spoke of a couple of instances of difficulties that she's had, for instance, with the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Yes, I think it is more difficult because of a lot of interests. But I guess what I'm saying is that there's still there are places of opening where it's possible.
Okay, I have... Is it on? Okay, I think we have time for maybe one more question, if that's okay. You can certainly come down and talk to Noah if you want to.
Okay, this is going to be a bit of a build-up, since I take it your approach is that of nexus. So let me frame it this way. Your question of place was... destroy and rebuild. And to move out from there, we have to think of the question of substitution, because I think your ultimate, well, not ultimate, but one of your questions is, where is Israel? And to move to that, let's look at a particular situation. In the 1980s, I knew a person who went to yeshiva in Tel Aviv, and he studied Kierkegaard, really the father of the absurd. You mentioned Kafka, but we can move back to Kierkegaard, if you will. And Kierkegaard frames that problem of thrownness, in particular, in terms of the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, Yitzhak. And here's the nexus. That story is also central, I believe, to the story of Ramadan and of Islam in particular. So now to hand the nexus back to you, where would you go with this?
This will be our next lecture.
So the question is, like, the is the relationship between two views of the absurd. I mean, yes, in Islam, the focus on the story of Abraham and Isaac becomes displaced to Abraham's other son, Ishmael. So the relationship is between Abraham's other wife and her son, Ishmael, who essentially is the father of Islam in many ways. And as opposed to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which are thought of as like the forefathers for Judaism. So yes, and as Kierkegaard is essentially a post-Enlightenment philosopher who's focusing on theological questions, there's this relationship between sort of theologies of Islam, theologies of Judaism, the way that both of those evolve into national struggles, and the kind of overall notion of like a non-theological philosophy attending to those issues. I think that when it comes down to the way that these artists exist as both citizens and practitioners, the way that they ask the question, where is Israel, is attending to like real things on the ground. You know, I mean, it can be informed by these histories, it can be informed by these philosophies, but if you remember, there's that image of Avi Mugerbi's studio with him on the phone. He's like in real time talking to a real person who is trapped in his own home. And that's intercut with these stories that are being told of a history and what it means and what it's supposed to mean to everyone who's standing there. And I think one of the most important things is to see that these larger kind of historical, theological, political, ideological sets of narratives must always come down to like the real lives of people and the way that those are revealed. And I think that Avi Mugerbi as an artist is someone who ultimately reveals that through a personal conversation that's put in a political context, but still acknowledging how that is informed by these larger ideological trends. That's the best answer I have right now.
Yeah.